Welcome to the doctoral dissertation by Antti Pihlajamäki. The title of the thesis is Machine Learning Approach to Atomistic Simulations of Protected Cold Nanoclusters. The opponent is Assistant Professor Milica Todorovic, remotely from the University of Turku. Welcome, Dr. Todorovic. As a technical note, The sound from the remote opponent comes from this quite small speaker here on the front, not from the large speaker. So at any point, if you there on the back don't hear clearly, I would like to hear more of the questions of the opponent, you are free to come here more to the front. And maybe a good idea to do it now and not in the middle of the discussion, if you feel so. So as the custos appointed by the faculty, I declare this public examination open.
Arvoisa kustos, kunnioitettu vastaväittäjä, hyvät kuulijat. Väitöskirjassa tiivistyvät hyvin läheisesti kaksi eri teemaa. Suojatut metallinanopartikkelit ja koneoppiminen. Ja tämän lyhyen johdantolektion aikana pyrin antamaan yleiskuvan, mistä tässä oikeastaan on kyse. Mitä nämä suojatut nanopartikkelit oikeastaan ovat? Kaiken keskiössä on metallinen ydin, joka kuten tässä esimerkissä koostuu kullasta. Mutta se voi koostua myöskin monesta eri metallista, kuten hopeasta, kuparista, alumiinista, palladiumista tai jostain näiden seoksesta. Ja tällaiset suojaamattomat tai paljaat nanopartikkelit ovat kuitenkin hyvin reaktiivisia. Ne usein liittyvät yhteen toisiinsa muodostaen suurempia nanopartikkeleita, tai ne saattavat esimerkiksi reagoida ympäristön kanssa hapettuen. Ja jotta näitä voitaisiin hyödyntää joissain sovelluksissa, niin on usein mielekästä, että niiden kokoa voitaisiin hallita. Ja tätä varten on kehitetty menetelmä muodostaa niin sanottu suojaava kerros näiden ympärille. Ja tämän suojaavan kerroksen ensimmäinen osa on niin sanottu rajapintarakenne, joka usein koostuu muun muassa rikistä, fosforista tai jostain muusta vastaavasta alkuaineesta, joka pystyy muodostamaan sidoksia näiden kulta- tai minkä tahansa metalliatomin kanssa. Ja kuten tässä esimerkissä, rikki on muodostanut sidoksia ylimääräisten kulta-atomien kanssa. Tämä rajapinta sellaisena ei vielä tee yhtään mitään, vaan se toimii sitoutumispaikkana näille varsinaisille orgaanillisille molekyyleille, eli likandeille. Ja nämä stabiloivat tämän nanopartikkelin rakenteen siten, että sen rakenne voidaan määrittää atomin tarkkuudella. Mutta nämä ei ole pelkästään näiden rakenteen stabilointia varten, vaan sitä voidaan myös hyödyntää tämän funktionalisointiin. Ja näin näiden nanopartikkelien ominaisuuksia voidaan muokata muokkaamalla näitä ydintä tai likandikerrosta tai molempia, jolloin näitä voidaan hyödyntää esimerkiksi nanolääketieteessä, biologisten näytteiden kuvantamisessa tai vaikka esimerkiksi katalyyttisissä reaktioissa. Vaikka näitä voidaan tutkiakin hyvin tarkasti kokeellisestikin, niin me emme käytännössä katsoen koskaan kuitenkaan näe, mitä atomitasolla tapahtuu. Ja tätä varten tarvitaan teoreettisia menetelmiä ja laskennallista tutkimusta. Ja laskennallisen tutkimuksen tai laskennallisten menetelmien taustalla on yleensä ratkaista Schrödingerin yhtälöstä eli kvanttimekaniikisista vuorovaikutuksista niin sanottu aaltofunktio. Tämä on kuitenkin hyvin vaikeaa, kuten tässä esimerkissäkin se on ratkaistu vain tai on esitetty vain yksinkertaiselle vetyatomille, jossa on vain positiivinen ydin ja yksi ainut elektroni. Kun taas esimerkiksi kullan tapauksessa siinä on 79 elektronia, jolloin vuorovaikutuksia on niin paljon, että sitä ei voida laskea enää käsin. Vaan tätä varten tarvitaan erilaisia yksinkertaistuksia tai erilaisia lähtökohtia. Ja näistä tyypillisin on käyttää niin sanottua tiheysfunktionaaliteoriaa. Tiheysfunktionaaliteorian ideana on, että ei käsitellä enää tätä aaltofunktiota, joka kuvaisi käytännössä katsoen kaiken atomien atomisella tasolla, vaan käsitelläänkin elektronitiheyttä, joka on paljon kätevämpi tapa laskea ja pystytään käsittelemään paljon mielekkäämmin kuin näitä aaltofunktioita. Tämä on kuitenkin edelleen laskennallisesti hyvin raskasta ja tätä varten tarvitaan edelleen supertietokoneita, kuten Mahti tässä kuvassa, jotta näitä voitaisiin laskea mitenkään realistisissa aikaskaaloissa. Toinen vielä tästä eteenpäin menevä yksinkertaistus on käyttää niin sanottuja voimakenttiä. Eli jätetään koko elektronirakenne syrjään ja kuvataan atomien välinen vuorovaikutus ennalta määrättyjen matemaattisten funktioiden avulla. Tämä mahdollistaa hyvin tehokkaat ja nopeat laskut, mutta tässä menetetään monia ominaisuuksia ja tarkkuudessa, ja samoin myöskin näiden voimakenttien sovitus on työlästä, jotta saavutetaan niiden haluttu tarkkuus. Ja viimeisen 10-15 vuoden aikana on noussut esiin tällainen uuden tyyppinen ryhmämenetelmiä, niin sanottuja koneoppimismenetelmät. Ja näiden koneoppimismenetelmien tavoitteena on, että me voidaan opettaa tämä menetelmä tuottamaan tuloksia, jotka ovat näiden kvanttimekaanisten hyvin raskaiden laskujen tarkkuuden tasolla, mutta meidän laskennallinen aika tai laskennallinen tehokkuus olisi kuitenkin verrattavissa näihin voimakenttiin. Ja tämä oli näiden koneoppimismenetelmien kautta koneoppimispotentiaalien tai voimakenttien idea. Mutta mitä koneoppiminen oikeastaan on? Koneoppiminen liitetään usein termiin tekoäly. Mutta mitä tämä silti oikeastaan on? Tekoäly on korkean asteen termi, jonka alle koneoppiminen ja monet muut menetelmät kuuluvat, kuten esimerkiksi kuvantunnistus, konenäkö, syvä oppiminen, klusterointi, luokittelu, mitä näitä menetelmiä ikinä onkaan. Ja tämä on eräänlainen termien viidakko, näitä on hyvin, hyvin paljon erilaisia menetelmiä. Mutta tämä ei varsinaisesti vielä kerro, mitä koneoppiminen on, vaan mielestäni tämä pieni sarjakuva kuvaa täydellisesti, mistä koneoppimisessa oikeastaan on kyse. Koneoppiminen on vain kokoelma lineaarialgebrallisia menetelmiä, jotka pyrkivät löytämään korrelaatioita, eli riippuvuussuhteita niille annetusta datasta. Ja käytännössä katsoen niille voi syöttää lähes mitä tahansa, ja ne pyrkivät aina löytämään sieltä jonkinlaisia riippuvuussuhteita, olivat ne sitten todellisia tai kuvitteellisia. Tässä seuraavaksi pyrin antamaan pienen, hyvin yksinkertaisen esimerkin, mitä koneoppimisella voitaisiin tehdä. Tässä kuvassa idea on, että vaaka-akselilla meillä on jokin parametri, esimerkiksi jokin atomien etäisyys tai atomin paikka pinnalla, tai jokin esimerkiksi kokeellinen parametri, mitä voidaan muuttaa mitä ikinä tutkija haluaakaan. Ja pystyakselilla meillä on jokin ominaisuus, jota me halutaan tutkia. Ja tämä sininen käyrä tässä havainnollistaa vain sitä piilevää ominaisuutta, jota me emme vielä tunne. Käytännössä kuitenkaan me ei voida tarkkaan mitata sitä tai täysin tarkasti saavuttaa tuota sinistä käyrää, vaan meidän datassa on aina oma tasonsa epätarkkuutta ja erilaista kohinaa, jota tässä näille mustilla pisteillä yritetään havainnollistaa. Eli jokainen piste kuvaa ikään kuin yhtä mittausta tai datapistettä laskusta, ja pystyakselilla huomataan, että niissä on oma määrä epätarkkuutta. Katsomalla näitä pelkkiä pisteitä, niin pelkään oppilaslaboratoriokokemuksen pohjalta siinä tulee ensimmäisenä ideana sovittaa jokin käyrä. Ja usein tämä on riittävä jossain yksinkertaisissa tilanteissa. Tämä voi tuottaa hyvinkin hyvän käyttäytymisen. Mutta käytännössä katsoen mikään realistinen ongelma ei ole näin yksinkertainen, että se olisi vain yhdessä ulottuvuudessa ja mitattaisiin vain yhtä arvoa. Vaan meidän data on käytännössä katsoen aina hyvin korkeaulotteista, se, joka tässä tapauksessa tarkoittaa sitä, että yhtä esimerkiksi atomirakenteen tilaa kuvaavat esimerkiksi useat sadat tai jopa tuhannet yksittäiset numerot, jotka toimivat ikään kuin mittarina jokaiselle erilaiselle ominaisuudelle. Ja tätä ei ihmissilmä tai ihmismieli pysty havainnollistamaan tai käsittämäänkään näin korkeaa ulottuvuutta. Ja tähän varten on kehitetty koneoppimismenetelmät löytämään ne korrelaatiot tästä korkeaulotteisesta datasta. Mutta koska nämä menetelmät on erittäin tehokkaita löytämään ne korrelaatiot, meidän täytyy olla myös hyvin tarkkoja ja varovaisia, miten niitä käytetään, koska usein saattaa käydä näin. Mitä tässä on tapahtunut, on koneoppimismenetelmä on pyrkinyt oppimaan täydellisesti jokikisen pisteen, mikä sille on annettu. Eli tämä malli on niin sanotusti ylioppinut. Se löytää täysin kaikkien pisteiden paikat, mitä se on ikinä nähnytkään. Mutta tällainen malli ei ole mitenkään hyödyllinen, koska me haluttiin alun perin löytää tuo sininen piilevä trendi tuolla datassa. Ja tätä varten meidän on ensin kerrottava tälle menetelmälle, että siellä on meidän datassa on kohinaa tai epätarkkuutta, joka saattaa johtua esimerkiksi, miten se on mitattu, tai laskennallisessa tutkimuksessa voi olla numerista virhettä, tai esimerkiksi yksinkertaisesti, miten dataa on käsitelty. Mutta kun tämä tieto annetaan mallille, niin me voidaan saavuttaa erittäinkin hyvin sovitettu malli, joka käyttäytyy jossain tapauksessa lähes täydellisesti tuon sinisen käyrän mukaisesti. Ja tämä ei ole kuitenkaan ainoa sovellus, mitä koneoppimisella voidaan tehdä. Tämä on vain yksi esimerkki niin sanotusta regressiosta, eli jatkuvien arvojen ennustamisesta. Mutta koneoppimisella voidaan myös esimerkiksi luokitella datapisteitä erilaisiin kategorioihin tai etsiä erilaisia ryhmiä siitä datasta tai mitä tahansa hyvin monimutkaisiakin ongelmia. Minun väitöskirjani taas koostuu kolmesta erillisestä tutkimuksesta. Ensimmäisessä olen hyödyntänyt hieman koneoppimismenetelmien sukua olevaa kuvien vertailuun käytettyä menetelmää, ja olen käyttänyt sitä vertaamaan tällaisen kulta-25 nanopartikkelin kokeellisia ja simuloitua elektronimikroskooppikuvia. Toisessa tutkimuksessa olen tällaisia niin sanottuja etäisyyspohjaisia koneoppimismenetelmiä opetettiin ennustamaan potentiaalienergioita tällaisen kulta-38 rakenteen erilaisille konfiguraatioille. Ja tämän jälkeen näitä potentiaalienergioita hyödynnettiin simulaatioissa imitoimaan tämän lämpövärähtelyä. Kolmas tutkimus on keskittyy paljon pienempiin osiin tästä ongelmasta. Missä potentiaalienergia on kokonaisen systeemin ominaisuus, niin tässä kolmannessa osassa keskityttiin niin sanottuihin voimavektoreihin, eli voimiin, jotka kohdistuvat yksittäisiin atomeihin rakenteessa. Ja tässä tutkimuksessa kehitin uuden version tästä etäisyyspohjaisista menetelmistä, jolla pystytään ennustamaan näitä voimia. Ja tämän jälkeen hyödynsin näitä voimia tällaisten kultananopartikkelien rakenteiden optimoimisessa, eli etsimään, mikä olisi mahdollisimman energeettisesti edullinen rakenne. Ja nämä kolme erillistä tutkimusta antavat hyvän yleiskuvan, mitä koneoppimisella oikeastaan voidaan tehdä, kun tutkitaan millaista tahansa nanorakenteita tai erityisesti tällaisia kemiallisesti ja fysikaalisesti hyvin monimutkaisia suojattuja nanopartikkeleita. Now I finish my lecture and should I just know? Yeah, Anut Professor Milica Todorovic, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Thank you, Antti, for your presentation. Before I start presenting my comments, an apology to everybody. I'm a little bit ill today, so I'm sorry if my voice is not up to scratch. But please let me know if you can't hear me well. I'll try to speak a little bit louder. Okay, so to put Antti's thesis in context, something that I thought about a lot when I read it was about the evolution of the scientific paradigm. And this is what I want to remind you of. And by scientific paradigm, I mean the way that we do science. And the way that we do science obviously has changed enormously over the centuries. And the very first way that people did science was experimental. So that was available all around us. So from prehistoric age, people experimented with the tools near them and learned more about the world. And then this experimental approach was lasting for a very, very long time until perhaps the Renaissance after the Middle Ages, when we started forming theories about the world around us, starting from Galilei and then onwards through Newton and Maxwell and until the 20th century and the birth of quantum mechanics. I think we all consider that like the golden age of theory, scientific theory. So that provided us with new tools and new ways of doing science and understanding the world around us. And then after the Second World War came the invention of the silicon chip technologies and computers. And with computers, eventually they grew into supercomputers, and it became possible to simulate materials, so to encode these theoretical equations that we all knew. And write computer programs and then run them so that we can understand the material on a nanoscale from a completely different viewpoint. After the computing power became very, very great in the 80s and the 90s, also the amount of data produced by these computer simulations grew. And eventually, about 10, 20 years ago, what also grew was our disk space and storage capability, and also the bandwidth of upload and download. And so it became possible to somehow store this data and accumulate them into repositories of computer data. And then this data kind of gave birth to another way of doing science, which is data science, or using this data as a resource to learn something new about materials. Even though this data came from computational simulations of materials, we were all surprised to find out that there are still many new things you could learn about materials just from the data. Perhaps something that really comes out of accumulation of a lot of data that was previously invisible to us from simply one simulation or two simulations. And this gave rise to data science, which is now growing into yet another way of doing science. And so now we are at the fourth paradigm, with the first being experiment, the second being theory, the third being computation, and the fourth being data science. And what impressed me about Andy's thesis is that he relies on all of these paradigms in a way to address a problem, an outstanding problem in material science. So the object of his studies are ligand protective matter clusters, or here they are NPCs, monolayer protected nanoclusters, so a small simplification to study the system. These systems are notoriously difficult to study, both experimentally and theoretically. People have tried from many ways. Experimentally, it's difficult to interpret the measurements. Either you can measure their structure through TEM, transmission electron microscopy, or you can measure their response through spectroscopy. Both responses and images are very difficult to interpret. And so here, Antti, I think, makes a good contribution in comparing simulated images to experimental images, so he can interpret best the structure of the clusters inside a crystal. So this is one contribution where he can facilitate better interpretation of experiments, so we can learn about the structure of these nano objects. The second way that he contributes is through computational science. So there are lots of density functional theory simulations in this thesis and data sets from density functional theory, or DFT. And so that's another paradigm, scientific paradigm. And then the third one is data science, where he uses this data from DFT to explore new methods of how to do data science for these structures. And here is another, I think, impressive aspect of the thesis. It is really not easy to do machine learning for some specific nanostructures, or nanostructures in general. Nobody really knows how to do this well. This is a very young field and it's growing very rapidly. So it only started about 5 to 10 years ago. And here I think Andy has a really nice exploration mindset, where he tries out different things. He's tried out different descriptors. He's tried out different data sets. He's tried out different machine learning methods. And this is really hard work, I have to say. So I think it's very nice that to see all of the results come together and to see what worked and what didn't work. And I also liked a lot his attitude in kind of discussing what worked and what didn't work and what we can learn from this. And I think this is a really important attitude when exploring new frontiers of research, which is undoubtedly what Andy has done. Especially when there's not really good understanding about how to use these tools, it's very important to discuss this and to understand it so that others who follow can build on this work. So I think, Antti, you did this very well. Okay, so I'm very curious to ask you about the details about some of what you have discussed. So perhaps let's switch away from the general assessment to some more specific questions, so make yourself comfortable. Can you all hear me well?
Yes, at least I can hear you well.
Okay. So let's start. I have some general questions for you in the beginning, related to the ligand-protected nanoclusters, or these monolayer-protected nanoclusters. So I've heard that these are huge for health technologies, but I'm not really aware of their current applications or if there are any applications. So you mentioned a couple in your thesis. Could you perhaps mention a single example where they are currently applied?
Yes, thank you. Actually, these monolayer protected clusters, or I will probably just call them mostly just clusters or particles, they have many, many, many different applications. And some of them, they are really used. Like, for example, in biological imaging, they are very useful because, as I mentioned in this introductory lecture in Finnish, we can functionalize these ligand layers. So it can bind to the specific locations or environments, for example, on the cell of the virus or proteins or any kind of a biological sample. And because they are containing metals like gold, so they are heavy, so we can see them in a microscopy way. And actually, there has been a research where they have been like tracking proteins in a living cell or visualizing the viruses. So that's the one very common application. Another one is that is currently in our group, there's one postdoc, Francisco Matus, who is researching how they can be used in this nanomedicine. Like same idea that you can functionalize this ligand cell. They bind to the certain parts of the proteins and they can be used, for example, to carry drugs into the cancer cells. So this is another example of more like a bio application. But when it comes into the, for example, to more to chemistry, there's a catalysis. And catalysis, there is currently, we are starting actually a project here, same idea, but it has been also studied quite a lot, that these monolayer protected clusters are actually quite powerful for catalysis. They can, for example, have a very specific site, which is like a pair from those ligands, and that specific site can work as a catalyst. And this can also be tuned with different, doping the cluster metals, like having if we have a gold and then we are adding like a copper or platinum or whatever we are adding there, that's a might change the catalytic properties. So those are at least a few, maybe most important applications, but of course there are more prototype way applications like using solar cells that I'm not very familiar with, but they have been tried on many applications.
Okay, this is a really nice review as we start this conversation. So a quick follow-up question. In these cases, for example, in the catalysis, usually catalytic activity comes from the exposed metal, but in this example, it actually, you say, comes from the ligands, the selective binding of ligands, or is it actually from the metal?
Yeah, that's something that is currently under research also, but it's more, yes, metal is actually the more important thing. It's more like how these ligands are behaving around this bare metal. Like in some nanoparticles, there might be a bare site, but it's just like surrounded by the ligands. So it can work as a very specific site for the catalytic reaction.
So then in this catalysis, then it's not fully saturated by the ligand, but yes, it does leave some exposed metal sites.
Exactly. There can be this kind of holes in the ligand shell in that sense. And actually the ligands can also participate in the catalytic reaction as in our group, there was also a study where this ligand works more like a fly trap. They capture the molecule onto the surface of the metal cluster and it was covered on the ligands, and when the reaction happened it just started to open. So it can work. It's a really complex reactions that might happen on these clusters, and it's still under very thorough studies.
Yes, that is totally true. That's why these are very, very complicated. So when you chose to study the monolayer protected ones with the thiolate groups, was this something that, and with the methyl groups, did you intend to simplify the system, or is this methyl kind of covered nanoparticle actually used in something?
Yes, that's a very good point. This is mostly for simplification because it's computationally quite heavy. If we have gold 25 cluster, there's 18 thiolates, and if we have every thiolate has a very long ligand there, it becomes a very complex and quite computationally heavy structure. So that's a one reason. And to be honest, there is also this kind of a practical reason that we had already long MD simulation data where we had already this kind of simplified ligands. But of course, this is not just, it is usually a simplification, but there are some protected clusters which has this kind of very simple methyl group or ethyl or something very simple, this kind of a thiolate ligands. But in our case, it's mostly for the simplification of the calculations.
Yeah, okay. This is by no means a bad thing. So don't feel bad about it. Actually, if you machine learn for gold, sulfur, carbon, and hydrogen, you have all the elements you need to go larger, right? So in principle, this is probably the minimal data set that or chemical diversity that you need already. So not bad at all. Okay. When you set out to study these clusters, obviously you developed a lot of methodology during the thesis, but when you developed this methodology, was it more important for you to study the structure or the functionality of these clusters?
Yes. So
by structure, I mean this literal atomistic arrangement, and by functionality, by how they interact with external matter.
Yes. So I think we were mostly focusing on the structure and how the structure behaves. Like in the first, like actual method, chronologically the first, so that was the predicting the potential energies and working with the Monte Carlo simulation. There we wanted to just see if we can see, for example, isomerization of these structures or something like that. But mostly because we didn't really want to start add too much to our models, because we are also very new to the field, this machine learning field. So we didn't want to go to the too complex reactions immediately. Like we are already working with a very complicated, physically and chemically very complicated systems. So it's first trying to focus something which is more clearer for us too.
Sure, no problem. Okay. So I was trying to clarify this in my mind so that I can understand your choice of methods. Obviously, it's very exciting that you've tried out some new machine learning methods and even went beyond energy predictions to force predictions. That's very exciting. But I have to ask you, if you were to roll back to the simplicity, different levels of describing the interactions between atoms, you mentioned that there are, of course, force fields, which tend to work well for organics, but not so well for hybrid systems like metals with organic matter. And of course, one big drawback that you pointed out in your thesis is that you have to tell the force fields when two atoms are bonded. So unless you use reactive force fields, which are very tricky, it won't create or break bonds. So from the point of view of studying the structure, did you decide to discard these kind of force fields for partly for that reason, for the inability to reproduce chemical bonding, or was it more about the parameterization?
This is
so are there also somewhat... any parameterizations, by the way, that you know of for these force fields, specifically for this kind of gold and organic content?
Yeah, this is actually somehow could be also somewhat practical issue also, because our group already has kind of expertise on these like classical force fields, like this amber chromax. Before me, there was one PhD student who actually created this parameterization for these thiolate protected gold clusters. And we already have now a new postdoc who is running mostly these classical force fields. And originally, our group is more expert on the density functional theory. So we wanted to more take this machine learning approach to add to our toolbox. So that's the most like a pressing reason why we are using machine learning and not these force fields. And of course, as you mentioned, in the force fields, you usually have to define these how the which atoms are bonded to which one. That of course makes all the chemical reactions impossible. So in that sense, you can also say that, for example, trying to find this isomerization, we pretty much need those have the machine learning potential or something related. So that because there has to be some bond that has to be broken to actually make this kind of a new arrangement of inside the structure.
Okay, thanks for framing this for me with the history. So I had thought if you're not studying the functions of formation of new bonds and only focusing on structure, perhaps I thought that these force field parametrizations might be accurate enough by now to study the structure. But I do understand that to go further, you kind of need either DFT input or machine learning based on DFT. So
yes, and if I can also add to that, there is this ReaxFF force fields also for these thiolate protected clusters, but they tend to produce sometimes very weird results or something which seems more or less unphysical. So those parameterizations are far from trivial. So we don't have really like a reactive force fields for these systems. We only have the classical one.
So even with the reactive ones, that they need a lot of they would need a lot of refinement. So here I must ask you, one way that people have been employing machine learning in material science is to learn the interactions and therefore improve on some of these force fields. And nowadays there are several approaches where the machine learning replaces the functional form, which avoids the limitations in accuracy that we are imposed upon us by the functional form. So there are these different approaches. Have you thought about perhaps, is this something that is a viable thing? I mean, not for your own work, but in your group, something that you would recommend that the researchers improve on?
Yes, that's actually quite interesting thing that I also realized just like during writing the thesis, like the last few months, I realized that there is this kind of hybrid approaches where you are using like a partially already well-developed method, and then you are adding machine learning to fix some difficult parts. Like actually, I saw this paper on using this density functional tight binding, where this repulsion term was done with the neural networks, which is usually like a usually it works a little bit like this exchange correlation functions in the DFT, where you just basically sweep all the difficult things under the rug and then you just apply actually a machine learning there instead of trying to make any kind of a mathematical or experimental fitting there. So I guess in some sense it would be quite viable. I also was thinking that it might be interesting if it could be like this kind of density functional tight binding idea could be used, because there is already available this kind of a parameterization. So if it could be like improved via this kind of a machine learning, that would be interesting. But yeah, it's definitely a one good field, because I think that purely relying on the methods that purely rely on machine learning, they have their own limitations. Like, of course, we have to generate a huge data set. And if we want to go chemically more complex ones, we have to make very complicated models. And that just takes a lot of work and effort and needs huge amount of data. And still, we most likely have to rely on deep learning methods, which then also requires quite large resources to even train the method. So there is, it's like, personally, I think this purely machine learning force fields have their own limitations. They are, of course, they are very powerful tools, but sometimes it might be very useful if we could just use already well-established method and then just fix some difficult parts with the machine learning.
Yes, I think you've put your finger on it exactly. It's very attractive to think that you can combine something like ReaxFF with the with some machine learned potentials like the neural network potentials or the gap potentials. But they are, of course, notoriously data hungry. And it is exponentially more difficult to train for every pair of elements in your system. So the more chemical diversity you have, the more data you need. And then it just becomes a huge, huge undertaking that perhaps overshadows solving the problem itself. And so in these, actually, that leads me to my next question. For these machine learning potentials, they tend to train them by sampling from MD trajectories. And this is something that your thesis also has in common. So you have chosen to sample from MD. And in the community every year, there's debates on should we do this or should we not? So maybe could you comment on the pros and cons of sampling from MD trajectories to learn about the energetics?
Yes, thank you. This is actually something that we learned on the hard way, I could say, because originally we started applying this kind of a minimal learning machine or this distance-based learning method for our data. And we had this two, these MD trajectories. And when we trained, we got very good results. Like it was just a spot on. But we were basically training the method with a part of the data and then we tested with the rest. So that basically, because it's a deterministic path, so in the retro perspective, it is of course obvious that we were actually trying to test our model with just the missing parts of the path that we already pretty much knew. So then this is like really a drawback of the using just the MD simulations. They are deterministic and they usually spend the most time on the structures where the energy is already close to minimum, and that's not very interesting. Like we could actually just train for something which vibrates in the harmonic region or something like that. And if you want to go more complex one, you would need a higher temperature MD runs, and because every path branches to its own way, then we would need several MD trajectories and so on and so on. So it's really hard to know when it's enough. And especially you get lots of these kind of structures that you really don't need. Like, but you can't really, on the other hand, you can't really discard them either. So they are there like in your data because you don't just have them.
So when you say the structures that you really don't need, you mean that because of the small time step in the trajectory, many, many steps are very, very similar to each other structurally and energetically.
Yes.
And so yes. Using all of those is a bit wasteful because you're learning the same thing, right?
Yes, and you even take a risk of overfitting there.
Yeah. Have you thought about using tricks to solve this? So for example, taking your entire trajectory and then clustering it somehow so that you can use a certain number of clusters to identify some different features or different parts of the trajectory and then picking only a couple from each cluster rather than the whole subset.
Yes, this is actually quite an interesting thing that because it's a there's actually two points that I want to mention. First of all is the because we are using this kind of a distance-based machine learning, which is just a version of kernel methods. So we have these reference points. So we are often using this kind of a different methods to sample from the data these reference points. Like in this force model, I use this so-called RS maximin, which basically first takes the point, which is in the close to the mean of the data or your data space. And then you try to maximize the distances between your sampled points. So next one should be as far as possible from the first one, and the third one is as far as possible from the two previous ones, and so on and so. So this actually samples very nicely, like evenly from the data. So this is actually that we also, or I used to sample those local atomic structures because there is just lots of this kind of, as you mentioned, the data clusters. So it's using this kind of method, you can get a very even picture of your data.
But this sampling method, right, it only considers the labels, so the energy, right, as a criterion for sampling in the middle and then to the top and to the bottom. And so across the entire energy range, right?
No, it does not care anything about what is on the output side. It only cares how this input side data is arranged in the data space. So that's
it's structural. So it only it looks at the structures and it looks at averages and extremes between the range of structures.
Yes, it's more like the description of the structure. So it's trying to get as like a preserve the shape of this data space in one sense by sampling as evenly as possible. Like you get lots of dense data or densely packed data in the close to the minimum, but then you have very sparse data on the high energy side. So it actually doesn't weight this at all if it's far away from the minimum or close to the minimum. So it takes equally amount of data.
Okay, so you did ensure a little bit so that you can sample structural diversity across
yes.
the entire range, right? So then my next question is, what was the range? Because you did mention that MDs have a lot of structures close to the minimum, but that depends a bit on how high you go with the temperature and for how long. So in the original data set, so how far did you go? You said something about until the structures started to decompose or something, but
yes,
how high was that?
Yes, that's a very important point. Like the original MDs trajectory that was actually calculated before I even started this thesis work, and it starts from the zero Kelvin, and it's heated little by little up to, I think it was like 1,100 or 1,200 Kelvin range. And it was pretty much heated as long as it started to really break the structures. Okay. Yeah, so it is very high temperature simulations, and it's very quickly, especially in this GOLD-38, there's those two isomers, Q isomer, which is more thermodynamically stable, and then there's a T isomer, which is less stable, let's say so. And that actually, this T isomer starts to break very fast. It starts to really enlarge itself, and in the end, it actually just breaks this kind of GOLD-38 ring out, totally ripping the structure apart.
So it starts to break apart from the thiolate bond?
Well, the whole core...
Or does the cluster just start to, like, decompose?
Yes, yes. But these gold-sulfur bonds are very strong. So, of course, these ring structures are favored.
Okay. And so this was all done with density functional theory, right? These trajectories.
Yes, that was originally done with the DFT. I haven't done it. It's data from our group when I started from the other project.
Yeah, of course. It's good to upcycle the data and to use previously computed data for data science. That's, I think, the name of the game. But I will ask you a little bit about DFT. So because the quality of the machine learning models obviously critically depends on data, as you note in your thesis. And DFT, of course, is the tool of choice in a lot of these simulations of nanoclusters because it balances reasonable computational accuracy, electronic level accuracy with computational cost. And what I wanted to ask you is, are there so the DFT has, like any methods, has some pros and cons, and there are some cons of the DFT methods too. So do you think that in this trajectory, in these simulations and in this data set, there are any aspects of DFT cons that could affect the accuracy of your machine learning model ultimately? And by this, I mean, I don't know, are relativistic corrections needed? Are the van der Waals interactions included? What about the choice of the functional? Does it matter? Does it not? I don't know. Maybe you can tell me.
Yes, that's a good point. That, of course, the level of DFT affects to quality of our data. This is not so straightforward to answer because there are many functionals that our group is also using, and this PBE functional that we are mostly using, it's something that is seen that it's usually
produces quite reasonable results in many cases. So it's like a first choice pretty much everywhere. And of course, there are some functionals, they little bit overestimate some bonds, like how strong they are. Of course, this might also appear in the data, but usually it's those are not so big issues, that, at least to our experience. It more comes when we want to play, when we want to study like a, for example, UVB spectroscopy, simulator spectra, then it's more crucial that if you are using what kind of functional you are using, because one functional might produce totally different spectrum. And for Vandevals, I don't think they are really playing a role here because we have so small ligands. And in the case of metals, those Vandevals are not really a thing. So it's a, if we would have larger ligands, of course, we should also consider these Vandevals interactions. They are, they would play a role. But in this simplified case, I think we have a quite reasonable accuracy there, taking into account that there is so much, so many options for the these functionals and even just for DFT codes, there is so many options currently. I think we have reasonable accuracy.
Yes, and remind me, in this was GPO, right? That yes. You had used for this trajectory. So what was the basis set that GPO uses? How is the wave function represented?
So it's a. This I'm not really not an expert in DFT calculation, so it's a.
Okay, so don't worry if you can't recall. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I am only asking because you mentioned that some functionals underbind and some overbind, and this depends a little bit also on the basis set choice. But I generally agree with you that PBE tends to predict very good structures. Perhaps electronic structure leaves something to be desired from PBE calculations, but that's not an issue here. So from the point of view of structural, it's should be sufficient. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So thanks for all of these responses helped me to kind of understand some of the key choices that you were making when you started this thesis. And now before we get down to discuss the machine learning, I wanted to ask you a few questions about your wavelet work, where you tried to work on image comparison between experiment and theory. So can you tell me again, what is a wavelet?
Yes, so wavelets are pretty much like wave packages. Like it's a
a functional form, right?
Yes, it's a like in this case, this kind of wavelet is just like it's a second derivative of the Gaussian function. So it's the name is already called a Mexican hat functional, or what is this? What's the name? What this was? But anyway, it's a. Looks kind of like if you would drop a water droplet to the surface of the water, it will cause really similar ripples, and this is looks quite closely like that. But there is of course many different kind of forms of these wavelets or wave packages. Like you could also use something which has some complex terms or many other choices. So it's pretty much in this case it's more or less just a trick to actually hide something like differences in the images. Like if you have a different size of the display package or wavelet, you can pick very different features from the images. Like if you have a very large one, you pretty much hide all the details from the image. You just take like a general idea of the image, if one could say so. And if you have a very small one, it picks very sharp little details, like all the when the darkness of the image changes, or if you have cut something out, it will pick also that very clearly.
So the shape of the wavelet somehow can be used to accentuate or hide features.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's kind of related to my next question. I found myself, why represent these point centers with wavelets instead of with a sum of a wavelets instead of, let's say, something Gaussian, something which would be maybe easier.
Sorry, you mean the points like when we generate the simulated images, or
exactly? So kind of present the atomic positions with these wavelet functions, right? And then sum them up, and that.
I had to clarify this. Wavelets are not really presenting this atomics at all. They are like the atoms are presented as a Gaussian functions, and we use those to generate the simulated TEM image, and from TEM image we handle with these wavelets. And this Gaussian, this method is that is actually, I don't know what, I think it's some experimental paper from Physics Review B article. I think it was actually they chose this in some sense like interesting parameters, like a white atomic number to the power of 1.5. And so it's actually something which is tested to produce quite similar, this kind of a transmission electron microscopy images as these experiments would produce. And this is something that also my second supervisor was actually doing this initially, these images, when we saw this experimental TEM image, because, we saw some interesting features there, like there was like connecting gold atoms between the clusters and so on. And when we wanted to actually analyze this data, which we first produced this simulated images with this Gaussian style functions, we wanted to somehow compare them. We had this, actually our previous PhD student used this kind of an point-wise, like fitting the maximum and minima of those STM images, but that method could not be used really, because STM images are naturally very different compared to these TEM images. So then I had to figure out some kind of way which is not so dependent on made like a tiny differences. Like in this case, these wavelets are actually like trying to hide some of the like noise in the images, because the simulated image even have these ligand effects, which are not really visible at all in the experiments. And at the same time, we all know that the experimental images always have some level of noise that is not present in our simulated images, so that wavelets can also a little bit hide that idea and that noise in the image, because it's a similar idea that if you would use the like a convolutional neural network, there's this convoluting like a filter or convoluting layer part there, which actually tries to find the actual meaningful parts and leaving something like a noise out of the calculation.
Okay. thanks for correcting me. I must have remembered wrong. So then you use the wavelets to study the difference between the experimental and the theoretical image and extract the meaning out of it, right?
Yes, exactly.
I have to ask, I understand that wavelets are a class of these small functions. Is there something special about this Mexican hat wavelet, which I would have liked to see a picture of this. I would have asked you to draw it had I been here. you described it nicely with the pebble falling in the water. But is there something specific about this, or are there other wavelets that could have done the trick, or... Do you know?
Yes, this is definitely not the only choice that could be done. It's mostly because it's very simple to program, and it's very simple to use, and it's really clear what it's doing. So that's the one reason. But it's definitely you could choose something else, like a Morlet wavelet, which has then this kind of a complex part. And you could actually try to use different wavelets to pick very different properties from the image. So there is nothing really that specific why there is this wavelet used. It was more of a good first choice because it has been already used, for example, in computer vision. I think it was already 80s or 70s. It was already used to pick edges from the images. So you can, it's a similar idea that you make a wavelet transformation and it's actually picks those small edges from the image. And actually the original way how this whole wavelet comparison was done, they were using this kind of a so-called steerable pyramid decomposition, where you actually make a Fourier transformation for the image. And then you actually downsample it, make it, and put it through some filter layers, like there's orientation filter and high pass and low pass filters. And then you actually creating this kind of pyramid of different transformation of the image. And actually in the original paper, they used that one to run this wavelet comparison method. So definitely there are many other options too, but this was mostly, I wanted to choose something simple because this was also for me totally new thing. I have never done image analysis before this. So it was some clear choice. And because it has already worked for computer vision, so I didn't see any reason why it shouldn't work also for this kind of a microscopy images.
Well, fair enough. Maybe my question was a bit too detailed. I'm sure you could tweak the methods in many ways. The truth of the matter is that it's so difficult to compare experiment and theory because of the noise that it's really unclear what detail in the small details in the methods could actually improve it, because it's you improve on one thing, you lose another as well. That's always very difficult. So then I wanted to ask you about the results. So one, you were able to establish some things with certainty. So in these images, you definitely identify isomer one as the dominant conformation in the crystal. But then you said that you were not sure about isomer two, and you were able to get some detail about the orientation as well, pretty clearly. But what about the rest?
Yes, the analysis of the results is not that straightforward, I would say. I guess it's one that we could quite clearly conclude that it's an isomer one and not the isomer two. Okay. That's also supported by the experimentalists. They also, because we are also studying this, we got quite close to this when we got this TEM images first time. We were actually, our calculations were actually producing this kind of a new isomer or topological isomer for this COL25. But that currently, when I started this image comparison, we did not really, there was no experimental evidence yet. So that was something that we wanted to also just exclude, because we knew how, or we just saw how flexible this structure can be, even though we were actually expecting that to be very rigid. And later there were these experiments that actually showed that its spectrum is also changing. So its UVV spectrum is quite different on these two different isomers. So actually that should have also been seen in the spectrum. But that's also supports that it should be this isomer one, not the isomer two. So that's something that we can quite nicely also say from this, like just comparing the images, and also the experiments are pretty much supporting that idea. And there was actually some mentions at the some or some mentioned from other talks that it might be, is there a possibility to be a mixture, or might there be other cluster sizes? Other cluster sizes are pretty much or totally ruled out, because it's these MPCs are so funny things that they can be synthesized with quite precisely, that we always have usually yielding just one type of clusters, and this COL25 is one of the most stable ones. Being the mixture, maybe not. That cannot be really clearly ruled out either. But one, I would say that it's a when I analyze this orientation, how it might be oriented on the this crystal, that's also a little bit vague. Like I had some ideas that are most likely the orientation, but this Gold 25, it's pretty much an icosahedron, so it's so symmetric, so it's a really hard to say. And especially because in my main thesis, there is no image about this, but there's actually these clusters are actually linked together. So they have opened like asymmetrically this one protecting unit, and they are actually linking together. So there is actually, if you have looked at the TEM image, that the experimental one, there is so small black dots between the bigger ones. And those are actually single gold atoms. So that actually also deforms a little bit the structure, because some gold atoms has left the actual main core of this MPC. And that's in the simulated image, we didn't do that because it's really difficult to say how you open the structure or how open the unit.
Right, I understand. This is quite complex, especially when they crystallize. I think behavior in solution is one thing, and they're more or less independent and only have a solvent around them. But when they're crystallized, then completely new effects could arise. And so these experimental images were of a more complex monolayer protected cluster, right? So that ligand was much larger here than what you had studied later in the calculation. So do you envisage that perhaps the structural identification you've made in your thesis can perhaps help the next student in your group to apply your machine learned energies and forces to study ligands of this size or clusters of this size?
Yes, that's a hopefully it could, like especially if you fix the like a core, don't let the gold atoms move at all, or just even maybe even the like a this unit structure that, so that only the ligands are pretty much moving, then maybe mm-hmm. that would be a very then there would be a very well-defined structure, so it's a very reasonable that it might be working, because then you don't have to generate as like a model which would handle both these organic ligands and also fully metallic core and the something between. So it's a hopefully it could be. And yeah, it's a working with this kind of very large ligands, it's a very not that it's simple. Difficult. Yes, it's
yeah, I understand. But it's nice to imagine that the advances you've made from these different parts of your thesis could then in the future come together. Yes. In the future studies. Okay, so let's move on past this work to more of the core aspects of your thesis, which are related to machine learning. And I had a couple of questions, first about the descriptors. So obviously, the choice of descriptor is very difficult, and the use of descriptors is very difficult, as you might have discovered yourself. Certainly it happens to all of us. So I noticed that you chose the MBTR and the SOAP descriptors for this work. So could you maybe tell me why you made this choice and what would be the pros and the cons of each one of them?
Yes, that is descriptors really are not the trivial thing at all in the machine learning field. Like I always started with this MBTR, many-body tensor representation. It was more like I would say it was somehow a coincidence that we actually started using this one, because it's a there's just like a story that I attended to the physics days and I saw a poster about this, actually this described package from Aalto University. Some student was presenting it, and there this MBTR was very I think it's a very clean and a nice idea, like how it's creates this kind of like broadened feature map, or one could say that you measure inverse of the pairwise distances and then you add this Gaussian broadening and weighting for those. But that was mostly because we already were quite sure that using, for example, the Coulomb matrix or what those derived other those matrix representation from that, they felt very simplified, taking into account that we have very complicated structure, which most likely would have been the case. We really didn't even test those. We just made the initial test with this MBTR, and it produced firstly it was not really, even though the results were very good, but that was because we were testing with the same MD trajectories. But later it was also, it seemed to work quite reasonably well. And of course there is I did not discuss it on the main thesis. It was in the original article. There was also mentioning why we updated these parameters in the article number 2. Was because you can actually even see in the MBTR representation that there is like two distances for the gold sulfur, or two main peaks for the gold sulfur term. So you can actually, even this representation, you can see that, okay, there is like a second nearest neighbor and the first nearest neighbor contributions in that. So that was actually very nice to even see this kind of features that we know from the structure. And that was mostly because we then more like a stick with it because it was felt very natural. And of course, it has those many terms. You have this pairwise distance part, and then you can have a three-body term having those angles. And that was actually also tried at some point. We had this kind of a stacked machine learning approach where we had first one model that was actually predicting what from this pairwise distance representation, what would be this angular representation, because there is so many atoms in our cluster, so the just calculating the description was very inefficient. So it took way too much long to even make a representation with this angular term. So we just didn't really use that. But it's very flexible. You can measure very interesting things with that one. When it came to SOAP, there was more or less, because it felt it's more like a state-of-the-art description. Currently, there are many other options. Yeah, there was mostly, the reason was that there were not really other, like a very, how to say, the good options. Like if we could use those atomic center symmetry functions, that would have been one option. But it's those are also that you had to all by yourself also know what parameters you are inputting there, because you had to always, it gives for one, with one parameter set, it always gives just one number. So we would have generated a good set of different parameters and then use that one. So the SOAP was actually just feeling very good, feel like it's just trying the data. And actually, also when I was developing this force model, I made some initial tests with some aluminum cluster data. It was aluminum particles, just no ligands, just a bare metal particles. And there, this SOAP descriptor produced very nice, this kind of predictions for like norms of the force. So that was actually, so that, okay, it's producing so good results, so why not to use that one? So of course, there are many other options currently. And then there is, of course, the practical thing. It's implemented in this describe package, and it's implemented very well. So it was very natural to use that one. It's very user-friendly also. It gives a really very well-optimized results.
Okay, it's good to hear this overview. Of course, there is no hard rule over which descriptor to use, so this is all fair enough. And of course, you do have some very different properties with the two descriptor. MBTR is known as a global descriptor, in a sense. It It covers all of the structural features, whereas SOAP is more of a local descriptor. So it focuses on learning the local chemical environment around an atom. And so perhaps you can then use these different aspects of these two descriptors to also create different kinds of machine learning models. I noticed that you use only K2 term in the MBTR. So I should point out that the Coulomb matrix also only considers the bond distances and encodes them in the matrix. So yeah, it will be, of course, Coulomb matrix versus MBTR at K2 only. Usually the MBTR comes up on top in terms of accuracy, even though they somehow encode the same information. So it's just as well you went straight to the MBTR to get that higher accuracy. What was the size of your descriptor in terms of MBTR like length? Do you recall?
Yes, it was because we had, well, without cutting any information out, we had 4 elements. So it's a 4x4. And then we had the 100 in a one. Like
discretized point.
Yes. So it's like before cutting anything out, it's like a 1600. So it's a... But of course, it's supposedly symmetric if there is no numeric things going on. In some implementation, we also, in our group, Joachim Linia was actually testing also another implementation of this MBTR. And there we encoded, there is some numeric terms, so it wasn't totally symmetric. It was little difference. It was some weird numeric things were happening because in the implementation, but in the describe package, it's done so well that no problems at all.
No side effect. Okay, good. So you mentioned that these descriptors are somehow, to some extent, user-friendly, but what is not user-friendly are all the parameters that you need to worry about and also how to set them. So as you pointed out, every time you change a parameter, you just get a different number, different error coming out. So can you tell me a little bit about the strategies for optimizing hyperparameters of descriptors? So what strategies have you adopted and why?
Well, of course, there are many approaches for that. But in this, like using the MBTR approach was very, let's say, not that robust, I would say. It was more like just using physicist intuition partially, because we first made using the first set of parameters, and we produced reasonable potential energies. But when I ran the Monte Carlo simulation, the structures were all over the place. It was totally a mess. Like ligands breaking out and metals escaping from the core. So it's a wasn't working so well. So it's a I started to like really look into the just printing out how the description actually looks like, and I realized that I can see actually some bond terms, and this was just based on the literature that I had read and knew this statistically, because I had worked on those, like collecting some statistics on these structures, that I knew that what bond length and what distance these second nearest neighbors all should be. So I was more or less tuning the parameters so that I can see that it forms the peaks where it actually should physically be. So this was more like a human interaction way to do it. Of course, that is not really like the, I would say, correct or robust way to do it in one sense. With the SOAP parameter, I was more like thorough with that. I pretty much generated a set of parameters. I ran a small models for every one of them. And because I had the data from two different isomers of the same structure, so I could like make a little bit like a cross-validation way that I trained with the one isomer and tested with another and vice versa. And then I could get a very like a pretty much a table of different kind of RMSE errors for every different parameter set. And that is more, I would say that is pretty much the only way if you don't have any idea what to do with the hyperparameters. Like, especially in the case of SOAP, it's really, they are in some sense might be even a little counterintuitive what parameters to use, because it's It's not something like in MBTR, it's something you can really visualize by yourself and knowing from your actual atomic structures.
Okay, I think it's interesting to see how your understanding of this topic has evolved during your thesis, because what you said at the end was absolutely right. It is very difficult to extract physical meaning from these descriptors as much as we would like to. And some physical meaning is encoded into the MBTR and the broadening of the peaks, but it's almost impossible to predict also what broadening might lead to smallest errors. We always have an intuition that we don't want to broaden too much to lose the peak structure, but counterintuitively, sometimes very large broadening of that type produces the smallest errors in the machine learning methods, and then we just don't really know why this happens. So I think I agree with you what you said in the end about SOAP. I think just trying out different combinations and then looking at which produce the smallest error ultimately is the only way to come up with the best combination, because otherwise it's very difficult humanly to guess. And I do appreciate this is laborious because you have to try out many combinations. One thing that I wanted to suggest to you is grid search. This is what a lot of people tend to do, either for searching the space of n different parameters at the same time, so an n-dimensional search. And in n dimensions, you have the options of doing grid search for the hyperparameters or even a random search. So randomly create groups of combinations for the n different parameters. And other approaches are to go hierarchically and to decide which parameters are least important, set those first, and then maybe then focus the n dimensional search on fewer parameters that are perhaps more important for the ultimate performance. So there are different approaches just because we have to basically just do it many times. And also with the MBTR. Okay. And then you have touched upon this other aspect, which is the issue of the data set in supervised learning. So the issue of the training set and the test set. So I've noticed that you mentioned that you trained on one isomer and you predict for the other. And this is something that you've used to test the predictive power and the transferability of your method. Why do you think this is a better approach than perhaps combining all the snapshots and then taking the training set from there and also taking the test set from there? So making the training and the test set both combination data sets instead of making training set one and test set the other.
Yes, that's a good point. Like, definitely that would be a one approach, like really just training with a mix, pretty much the same way as you would do with normally with for example, neural networks or pretty much any machine learning method where you just make a small batches of data, like a cross-validation way. That might be also doable, but in this case, I more or less wanted to, because I had a clear division of this data. I had one isomer Q and isomer T, and because they are supposedly, they are still the isomers of the same structure. So they are supposedly, I could, if you had seen only the Gold38Q, I supposedly should be also able to simulate somehow the T isomer. So that's actually my logic there. Like, of course, if I'm using the MBTR with a global model, I think in that case, I couldn't work like that, because they have very different kind of these protecting units. Like this T isomer has this two like extra long units I mentioned in the introduction, which had like four of those thiolates. Like in normally long unit has a three and the short unit two, but it also, this T isomer has these shorter ones and also one thiolate on the bridge side of the core. So it's a very different structure compared to this Q isomer. So actually, if it's MBTR, which is a global descriptor, it would see this difference. In that sense, it shouldn't work. But when I'm working with a local descriptor, I see only the very local environment. So it shouldn't be causing any issues. So I should be able, if I know how the T isomer works, I'm supposedly should be able to also predict how the so-called more simple Q isomer would work. So that was the logic there. Of course, I think it might be also totally reasonable approach to just mix the two data sets and sample, make this kind of batches of data. That might also be totally reasonable approach.
The reason why I'm asking is because of the matters of interpolation and extrapolation. So as you commented also in your Monte Carlo study, the machine learning models are very good at interpolating, so predicting in the region where the data set is coming from. But if you ask it to predict outside of that sample, then this can be problematic. This interpolation is basically the weak spot for all the machine learning models. And so that's the reason why I'm asking, if you have two isomer sets and you train on one, you're asking it to extrapolate on the other, even though they might be close. But if you mix the two together, then you join the two spaces, and then you're asking your machine learning model to interpolate only. And that might be an easier task. But of course, as you said, the chemical environment here is so similar between the two that perhaps no additional advantage would be gained by mixing the data sets.
And I like to add to that, that the when I'm separating these data sets, it's only for the parameter testing. When I'm training the actual models, when I have the most optimal parameters, I mix the data. In the final model, I still have both. In the training set, I have both. And then I just test them separately because I want to visualize that which isomer is predicted better.
But even in the hyperparameter prediction, as you pointed out, you train the MBTR in the Monte Carlo study on one subset. And then you realize that when you started doing Monte Carlo, then the atoms were popping out all over the place. And these are configurations that the MBTR hasn't been trained for. And so it caused another problem in the machine learning. Yeah. So it does matter that you train your descriptor hyperparameters on exactly the same data set you plan to train the machine learning on. So it's meant to be globally valid throughout the rest of the process. But it is very difficult. So one last question on the descriptors. So you mentioned when you developed the methods for the orientation of forces prediction, so on the alkyne data set, you said you used the suboptimal descriptor, so SOAP wasn't optimized, and you actually went to use other tools like the Huber regression to make the learning more robust. So I have to ask, why didn't you just optimize SOAP?
Well, this is
really would it have been easier in the hindsight?
Yeah, it is actually. I would have liked to optimize it, but to be honest, back then it was a time constraint thing, because it was a deadline was a few weeks ago or a few weeks from that time when we got, okay, maybe we should publish this first version of the model. So I really was more working that how I can make my model to stay together, and not so much that my data would be optimal, because I knew also that if I can use this method, I would then for this cluster and data set, I would have to anyways optimize it. So I didn't really, I just picked something that I have been playing around, something that actually with aluminum cluster, aluminum just these bare particles that I had been playing around, that actually those parameters worked reasonably. They produced very reasonable results, but of course for carbohydrates or alkanes, it's a really different system, so it's expected to be not very good. But it was more for there, it's more important that the basic methodology, showing that okay, we have developed this kind of orientation adaptive method, and then for the actual application that is still under process of publishing, that there we actually made this optimizing also this description.
Yeah, I understand. When the time came to combine everything together, then you optimized everything for your system. Okay. So I'm sorry, I have so many questions about the methods because, of course, I'm very interested. So let me ask you a couple about the kernel-based methods of distant learning. So the first thing that tickled me is that on page 5, you said that the kernels were more interpretable than neural networks. I think we can safely say anything is more interpretable than neural networks, but I never thought that kernels are particularly interpretable. So in which way do you mean?
Yeah, in one sense, yeah, they are not that well interpretable, but in one sense, you could use those like a kernel functions in one sense to extract information. Like if, for example, let's say that you have some data point and you give it your method and you form this kind of a vector of those kernel values compared to your references. And then you see that, for example, if you have this radial basis function kernel, everything is very small values, or you have a distance based and then you have everything is very large values, you know that you are probably going outside your like a training region. So it's a, that way you could like interpret a little bit like what your data is doing there. But, and another way is that you can actually, in one sense, the whole image analysis method is actually pretty much a kernel, because it takes image A and image B, makes this wavelet transformation, and then it gives you a value between 1 and 0. So that, in one sense, can be thought as a, some one kind of kernel. So in that sense, they are interpretable and you can use them to extract some information. Of course, when you are like trying to predict like a potential energy or whatever value from the atomic data, it's not that clear like what is happening. I agree with that. But in that way, my idea was that in the deep neural networks, you have a really huge amount of those weights and parameters that you are optimizing during the training. And then often it's just a black box. Like in some cases, if you have image data, you can go back to like see what pixels are weighted the most during the, like, for example, trying to find some features from the image. That way you can interpret something, but in the one sense, it's sometimes even counterintuitive how a deep learning can work when you might have more weights or those parameters than what you have data. It's like an ill-posed problem, but it still somehow manages to learn it in some cases like exceptionally well. So in that sense, you just really don't know what happened inside. Like in kernel, you have a little bit more control on that.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that. But it's interesting to hear how you're thinking about the kernel-based methods. So a quick question about kernel ridge aggression then, because the methods that you're using, this is very nice to actually see different methods in your thesis. And thank you for that. It's good to see these tests and to see how they are performing. And these methods, of course, are very close to kernel ridge aggression, which has been used a lot on different materials in this field before. So have you considered, of course, the EMLM, as you pointed out, is very close to kernel ridge aggression, but with the Euclidean distance kernel. Have you thought about also reproducing some parts of your work or with just kernel ridge aggression, the plain vanilla one, so that the rest of us can also see how the distance-based methods perform next to kernel ridge aggression, the classical one?
Yes,
it's a benchmark test. Yeah. That's not really like particularly valuable, but just for the information and continuity, because we've got so much information about kernel ridge regression and how that behaves. So it could give us like some idea of when to use distance-based methods over kernel ridge regression.
Yes, so like this EMLM, what I have been using it, I have, for example, mostly for this predicting the force norms. Back then, I actually tried several different kernels and kernel ridge regression, and pretty much all the results were pretty much the same. So as expected, it was slight changes depending on what kind of a kernel you are using. Like in like Gaussian and Euclidean distance were pretty much the same, and but you could also like do something weird, like taking a dot product, like this linear kernel, or maybe even like taking this cosine kernel or something very weird, and then you might get a little bit worse behavior, but still they are usually pretty much the same. But I haven't really compared like this MLM, like minimal learning machine, which is more like this, I would consider more like a core of these distance-based methods. Like this MLM is more like a special version, one could say, like just a nice to know idea also. But this minimal learning machine is pretty much, I could consider like a more important one. That I haven't really like compared anyhow. But it has some, in our group, there is a lot of expertise in the IT side. So it's really interesting that I can also have this privilege to see what kind of different features or different perks it might have. Like especially this minimal learning machine has quite rarely this kind of an overfitting. And it works very well even in the high dimensionality. Like there was Joachim Linnaeus, this same paper was actually very nicely showing that it's usually outperforms deep neural networks, which didn't have any kind of optimization when you are working with the high dimensional data. So it's a, but yeah, that's a little bit branching out. Like, no, haven't really made this kind of benchmarking by myself. There is some for this kind of compared like a deep learning and a minimal learning machine, but yeah, haven't really done any kind of official comparison.
Okay, fair enough. You had plenty to do on your own. Yeah. But that would have been a little bit helpful to round off this work. We also read a lot of these studies from computer science literature, and then you apply it to machine learning, to material science data, and it can be very different. So it's really useful to pick some classic materials data sets and to compare a couple of these methods just to understand what are their strengths and weaknesses, because of course, ultimately there's no one that's better than the rest. It's really about what is suitable for which data and which problem. And I think what your thesis is developing, or what we all should be developing, is this knowledge, growing this knowledge in the community. So when to pick one method over another, or which methods even to pick to test. So it's very useful to comment, to test a couple of methods together. And you have done a nice job of that, testing several different methods in your thesis. Before we move on, I have one last question about this orientation and the direction estimation. This is a very complicated methodology development because it has so many parts. So which segment of the methodology is most difficult, and what you think affects accuracy the most?
Yes, that is actually, I said, quite straightforward to answer. It's the environment and alignment, how you align this neighborhood environment. So it's because there is pretty much no way to or know what is the best way to do it. Like in here, I have used this kind of singular value decomposition to extract this kind of rotation matrix and then use that to align. But of course, that's just one way to do it. And actually just about a month ago was there in this conference, this in Italy, where we saw this very nice idea of using like autoencoders to extract this kind of an equivariant representations. And this kind of equivariant learning ideas could be really nicely implemented, or actually would help this alignment. And this is actually something that when I was doing revision for this article, actually, I've also highlighted that this is more like could be considered as like a proto equivariant learning method, because it's having this invariant part like in the SOAP, but it also like addresses this how the structure is oriented in the space. This alignment is still the main source of the inaccuracy, and I think it would most of these results would be improved if I would have a better way to align it, especially this metallic core. It's kind of a paradigm or a paradox, because it works well in the system where you have well-defined like a bonding environment, like in the thiolates. You have a very clearly that it has bonded to gold and there's one carbon, or then carbon is bound to sulfur and hydrogen and so on. So those are very well-defined structures. But when we are working in the core, metallic core, it's a really homogeneous. It's pretty much the nearest neighbor environment is pretty much the same in every direction. So it's really difficult to make the reliable alignment. But luckily, this whole framework, it just needs to have as systematic alignment as possible. It doesn't have to be like exact. It has to be, if it has a systematically, it's wrong, then it doesn't matter, because it can like cope with that systematicity. But if you have this kind of very random different orientations, then it starts to be an issue.
Okay. Yeah, this is definitely one open question, and there are lots of things to, now that you have put forward this this model and demonstrated how it can be implemented, I'm sure many others will now try and test out different ways of alignment and seeing if there's anything that can be done. If there is any one way that is the best, it might be that, as you say, we just end up working with systematic errors, and that's fine. Okay, so let's move on to the results, I think, to the final part. So I was much interested in the Monte Carlo simulations. So you have trained on this data set, and then you use Monte Carlo at some elevated temperatures to try and understand the structural features. So what were the research objectives for you in this Monte Carlo work? What were you aiming to learn from the Monte Carlo simulations?
That is a very interesting question, in a sense, because we had originally, the idea was immediately after we had published this method that we would see the isomerization like going from T isomer to Q isomer, or from Q to T isomer. Uh-huh. That would be interesting, or maybe find some another like a local minimum, maybe a third isomer. That would be an interesting one. And actually, back then, this was what, 2020, I ran like most of the summer. I just let them run in our local cluster, and just coming back after a few days and picking up the data and starting the calculations again, just trying to find if there is something interesting to see. And we had actually one student that was trying to analyze the data, but there was some interesting features that were referring that, okay, that was quite close, that there might have been something like picking out this bridge site sulfur, which is only present in the T isomer, if that could be picked out to form like a unit with another sulfur atoms, then that would be we could consider that as a new isomer, or at least a prototype for the going back to, for example, Q isomer. And that was mostly the idea, that now we had the model and then we might want mm-hmm. to do that. But unfortunately, because Monte Carlo is still a random walk in this large configurational space, so we didn't really find like a one clear path that, okay, it goes from this isomer to that one. So that was the idea, and I generated like a tens of thousands of configurations with this method, but not really like anything conclusive.
Okay, I mean, that's also fine. It's difficult to know when you first set out with this what will come out of the method. For me, the most interesting thing that came out of this method was how different were the configurations between the training set and the Monte Carlo ones. So why do you think this is?
First of all, in the Monte Carlo simulation, we fixed this sulfur carbon bond. Like it can like extend and rotate, but it's always this so that its methyl group works as a whole. So methyl group cannot like rotate so that the hydrogen atoms would be between carbon and the sulfur. So that was already a fixed one. So that's something different. But mostly I think it's during the random walk. First of all, it was pretty much blind to see that how this sulfur gold bonds are really behaving, because they are still, they are supposedly very strong bonds, but the model somehow doesn't really understand that. And actually, when I reoptimized or changed these MBTR parameters, where we could actually see this also the second nearest distances and such, then it actually started to keep those bonds much more rigid. They were, for some reason, it's when it knows that, okay, this like second nearest ones are also there. For some reason, then there is more information that the bonds should be quite rigid. And that is something I think quite logical, because then you know that this effect is coming from the second nearest and this effect is coming from the nearest neighbors. So it's, in one sense, it's a logical one that they are very different. And of course, the simulation methods are very different. Like one is Monte Carlo random walk and one is MD, which is deterministic. So that's one very crucial difference there.
Okay. But then accessing these structures, these Monte Carlo structures and parts of the configurational space described by Monte Carlo, then helped you to improve the model, right? By incorporating, so you did additional DFT simulations there and you incorporated this data into your training set, right?
Yeah, yes.
So what was the, I would have liked to see a little bit more tables in your thesis. So what were the accuracies before and after these, when it comes to energy prediction between these two data sets, right? That just the MD and then MD with the Monte Carlo DFT added.
Yes, that is actually a good point. I really, from now, I can't really recall how much they were different. Of course, I think that now I can't recall if I ran the, how much I ran with this broken model, because we had many different kind of prototypes, like one which we had this kind of like a real first version of with a variable selection, which we just tried to pick out some features from the MBTR which are important. And then we had this stacked model, which has like trying to produce this K3 or this angular information. And so...
So you tried a lot of things and there are lots of MAEs all over the place.
Yes, yes. But because we mostly were focusing on that, can we produce like anyhow physically reasonable structures? So we didn't, in this article, we didn't really report what were the accuracies for the like a pre-model, which was producing those very crazy structures where everything was breaking. But yeah, now I can't give you any kind of a concrete answer for this. They were, if I'm not totally mistaken, they were quite close, not that far away, because the test data is also MD simulation. So they are working in a somewhat similar space. But of course, the Monte Carlo was improving because it also sampled the data from a very different region of this configuration space.
So you had about 25K of MD data in total. I don't know how much was the training data. And how many of the Monte Carlo data did you then later add?
I think I had the very like a concrete numbers there somewhere. Oh, there it is. For QISMR, we added like a 1,580 configurations. And for TISMR, 2,124, very vague numbers, but they are just because we ran these DFT calculations, and at some point they were just so crazy, these structures, that DFT just didn't converge anymore. So it's
I understand. Yeah.
So that's why the odd numbers, but yeah, it's we added like roughly something like 3,600 or something like that. So
Okay, so then I understand that on top of what is effectively 20K original data set, that 3,000, okay, it's going to help to help with some extrapolation, perhaps, but it's not going to move the prediction accuracy too much. And I see from the figure 3.6, then this the RMSEs then on the energy were about 2.5 EV to 3 EV overall accuracy. Yeah. Well, what do you think about this accuracy? Is it good enough for doing MD or Monte Carlo?
Well, I think the accuracy is how much it was, almost 2.9 and 2.6 EV. So not that great in that sense if you compare it to the many other methods, which has can be like a point something the or even 0.0 something EV. But in taking into account that this is, first of all, this is a very large system and it's a global model and it's not constructed like many. Currently, the trend is to use this kind of like a local contributions to the potential energy. That's the pretty much the standard way currently to taking the that into the account. I think it's still reasonable in one sense, especially because the error is more or less systematic, as you can see in this figure 3.6. I think it's just like a slope is a little bit off. So I think if I would have calculated the RMSE with like corrected this kind of a slope, I guess the errors would be significantly better. In some sense, I would say. So I would say that it's enough to run this kind of Monte Carlo and try to find like a, at least rough, because we wanted to find those isomerization. So it's really, if it's enough accuracy, like just roughly give the good like a dynamics, I think it's just enough. Because in the end, if we see this isomerization, we will switch back to DFT because we want to know that is this really a thing.
Yeah, the reason why I'm asking is because I'm looking at figure 3.7 and there you're showing the energetics of the two isomers, the T and the Q isomers. And it's clear that one is lower energy than the other. And I was trying to estimate from this graph how many EV is actually the difference between them. So it looks like what, two?
I'd say around 1.5. Because
one and a half. Yeah.
And that's that is at least what we were estimating. It would be around that. And that is actually, as I think I mentioned in this text, that it's actually quite good difference because that's what DFT also gives for these two isomers. That DFT says that T is around 1.5 EV higher in energy than what the Q is.
Okay, good. So that's the so it seems that you got the energy difference correct.
Yes.
Even though the energy difference is below the resolution of your method when it comes to predictive accuracy,
yeah.
Right? So your predictive accuracy is up to 3 EV, like 2.5 to 3 EV, and that this energy difference is 1.5. So I would have thought that's not enough accuracy to get that right, but you are getting it right.
Yes.
So why do you think that is? Is it easier, let's put it this way, is it easier to predict energy differences or total energies, absolute values?
Yeah, I would say that it's like, as I mentioned, that it's like a systematically, there's a, like a, it's wrong. Systematically, the potential energy has some this error. But because we are now just working, the whole Monte Carlo is working like with energy differences, how much the energy changes if I take a step to this direction or this direction. And then it's it doesn't really care if the absolute values are correct. So in that sense, I think that's very important that it's we are not working with the absolute values. Yes, so that's
excellent, because you've just walked into my next question, which is, should we even then be attempting to train machine learning models on absolute values of total energy? Because as we all know, they could be into minus tens of thousands of EVs, right, depending on your system size. And that's a huge range. In the end, all the action is in the bottom three EVs, right? That's where all the differences are between the different structures we're interested in. So should we be aiming for total energy predictions, or should we try to reformulate the problem in a way that we are learning the differences between energies in some way?
That's a good point. In this method, we were actually, in every case, we are scaling the data. So we are actually not trying to predict this minus 600 something or minus 700 values, but we are actually just predicting values between 0 and 1. So it's more like we are squeezing this range, like our data is something like spread around, it seems like from the figure, something like a 10 EV. Like that's a spread of our test data. So we have just squeezed that to be between 0 and 1. And then we make a prediction, okay. We got some value between 0 and 1, then we just scale it back. So that's the one thing there. But of course, when we are training these very larger and complicated methods, it's especially if one wants to really go for a very transferable model, I think it's, in one sense, it's not like desirable to produce the global energy like that well. It's more like, especially if you are training this kind of a local machine learning method, which produces these local contributions, I think it's more important that this like a relative contribution is correct. Like if it stacks with other contributions correctly, then it's it should be enough. If it's like how much locally it affects to the potential energy. And yeah, it's in that sense, these kind of local approaches are, I think, currently taking over. No one really is anymore doing this kind of global models, even though there is discussion that global models have the potential to be in a very specific cases more accurate, but still it's do you want the accuracy on the very specific case, or do you want to have like a more transferable model for like some range of systems? It depends on what one wants.
Yeah, this is an excellent place to end that thought, because it's interesting how even in data science, the fourth paradigm of doing science, we come back to all the same problems that have been plaguing us in developing force fields and all of the other simulation methods. So balancing transferability with accuracy. Okay, so let's then jump to the last part of your thesis about the force learning. This is a very, very interesting aspect of your thesis, something very challenging, but with the potential for much impact. So from a technical point of view, I wasn't clear exactly with how many machine learning models are you training. So are you training just one model for the value and one for the orientation, or something else?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing there. I'm training one that is handling the norm and one that is handling the direction. So, and then I have, for every atom type, I have an own model. So in the end, I have here separated this problem to the 5 different types of atoms. And for every type, I have 2 models, one for norm and one for direction. So in the end, this whole framework has 10 small models combined.
Okay, and were the 10 learning in a very similar way? So if you were to compare the features of the models?
They are trained very similar, and the data that is produced for everything is like running the SOAP for every configuration that I have sampled for, first of all, from those same MD trajectories. Of course, it's not the whole trajectory anymore. It's just 1,000 configurations sampled from those, because I don't really want to have 10,000 or 25,000 if every atom or every cluster has 158 atoms. So it's just a huge amount of data. I don't have a hard drive or any place where to put that amount of data. So it's it becomes very cumbersome. So here I have trained the models with sampled using this RS Maximin. I have sampled in the test case, I have just 2,500 this kind of points that I'm using for training and also for the reference. And for MLM, which is producing these force norms, I'm training them with a 5,000 configuration because its MLM is so light model. It's just, you can pretty much give it any amount of data and it will still be very fast. When this direction estimation becomes very slow if you have very much references. So, but the training is pretty much the same. They have the same algorithms or same sampling method. They're separate data sets, but they are handling them very similar way.
Okay, and then you optimize the SOAP parameter combinations across the all of these different problems, right? So that that the error is minimized across these training tasks.
Yes, at least try to find some kind of a compromise because you can't really, it works, some accuracy work or works well for the another element and for some element it does not work that well. So it's some kind of a compromise here. And of course I could do this hyperparameter optimization like a forever and just try to tweak every little part of it. So it's at some point we just decided that okay, this
To stop somewhere.
Yeah, this is enough accuracy for this time. First I just run this predicting these force norms because that's very fast and fast to train these small MLM models. It can produce quite a lot of data when you are running this, but it's relatively fast. But when I use that one to first limit amount of those parameters that I in the end wanted to test with this direction model, because then that takes almost 1 or 2 magnitudes of more time to calculate those estimated directions. So then I, using those, I found a finalized this hyperparameter optimization. But yeah, it's a compromise over these elements because I did not want to have too many different kinds of SOAP parameterization for every single model. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. Just to simplify a little bit.
So then I wanted to ask you, what was the SOAP hyperparameter that was perhaps most critical for this, for the quality of the learning? Was there one where the hyperparameter change caused a big change in the way the model was being trained?
The Gaussian broadening is, of course, that affects a lot, which was funny thing that because I originally made some tests and it worked quite well with all metallic systems, it wasn't that picky about it. But when I added these covalently bonded parts, they wanted to be, it's much more smaller. So that's one thing. But of course, this both N and L were actually this, I like to call them this quantum numbers because they are pretty much the same idea. And they were actually also very important, mostly because N can be thought as how densely it will split this radial part, and L, how it splits this angular part. So especially for this carbon and that kind of a models, it really needed to be, N needs to be large enough. And you should also have enough this L parameter when working, just trying to predict those force norms for metallic core, it works. It does not need that large numbers of N and L. But yeah, this Gaussian broadening is probably the most having the most impact in general in every single model, but then you cannot really even discard this N and L either. They are also very crucial.
Good to know. The reason why I'm asking is because people have some idea about how to adjust SOAP for simpler prediction tasks, like for force magnitude, right? But when it comes to force orientation, which is a more complex prediction task, I'm wondering, so what kind of recommendations you can give to the next person coming along willing to use SOAP on their system? So basically just look at everything.
Pretty much. Parameters are the most one, but actually this cutoff radius, when you are about in the correct range, that's not that big difference. Like I had these 4 angstroms and a 5 angstrom. They were pretty much the same. They were not really playing a role. And of course, we could take a larger one, which might at some point help, but there's a risk that we are going towards a very specialized one. So I think those 3 parameters, first look the Gaussian, it has to be, especially for covalently bonded, it has to be small enough. You cannot add too much broadening. They will totally mess up, especially the carbon. It doesn't know anything what is happening after some adding too much broadening. And then N and L, they are pretty much also delimiting how much you are able to handle data, because in this case, I used this, I think it was N7, L4. And it means that for every atom, I have over 2000 length vectors describing this environment. So and when you're adding this N and L, it's also naturally adding the length of the vector quite significantly. So it's also a question how high dimensions you can handle with your model.
So what was the size of your SOAP as well on average?
It's just a little bit over 2000 numbers.
Okay.
So it's not too bad. Yes. It's a start to be large, especially when I was producing this, all these parameter sets, it started to be hundreds of gigabytes of data very fast when I'm trying these hyperparameter tests. But yeah, it's not that too bad though. It can be still go larger ones if one wants. But there is always, this is like, again, this compromise that if I make a too specialized description, I might have a very specialized model that cannot be transferred. And it's always some compromise there.
Yeah. Another thing I was interested in here is some learning curves to understand how data hungry these methods are and what is the rate of learning when it comes to orientation. So the problems related to a single scalar prediction task, like the force magnitudes, they are kind of well known and it's understood what amount of data is needed to learn them well. Although that's also good to kind of check with a learning curve. What about for the force orientation? Did you actually compute any learning curves to see how the accuracy goes down as the model sees more and more and more data? So that you might extrapolate, like what is the desired, I don't know, MAE accuracy and how much data you might need to get there.
That is a very good point. I really didn't make these learning curves. I had an idea that I should test this amount of reference points, because that's the most important parameter of these models, because for like MLM, minimal learning machine, has only one hyperparameter, and that's the number of references. So that's the
something. And you said you use all, right?
Yes, yes. So that's,
but how much is all?
Or in these models, I had only 2,500 those training points, and all are references. So they are quite small models. But yes, I was actually planning that I should try to make some predictions with or test different amounts of data and different percentages of as a references. I was planning to do that. In the end, I did not. Mostly was time constraints were the issue, because I had to also write the article and the thesis at some point. But yes, I was trying to also use like a double sized. I had the 5,000, and surprisingly enough, the accuracy is almost the same. It's a little bit better, but just a little bit. So it already has almost enough data that 2,500, which is actually quite interesting, because usually MLM is something like you have your data set and you take like about 80% of your training data as a reference. That is usually like a rule of thumb that is should be enough to extract or train the model well enough.
Okay. Well, that kind of leads to one other question I had related to this, and is if you had any ideas on how to Any systematic ways to improve the accuracy to push down the MAE on the force even more? And I had some hopes that from learning curves you might get some idea about how to do this, but let's see. Do you have any other ideas about how to improve the accuracy of the forces?
Yes, the main idea is that there should be a better neighborhood alignment method. That is main cause of the error here, because it's a like for like we can see here for the hydrogen, it is very well learned. It learns it very nicely. It's not, because it is very simple. You just have
the neighborhood is very consistent.
Yes, it does not really change anywhere. And same is, for example, sulfur. It's reasonable. And for gold units, that's also reasonable. Errors there are, I had to also mention that these errors, even they say like almost 25 degrees, it's a really weighted average is a 25 degrees. It's a, these figures looks worse than they actually are, because how they spread, that most of the data is still going to those lower angle parts. There is always those higher end terms, especially when you go to very small forces, because there this whole direction is very badly defined, because you have just a tiny change in the atomic environment, it might switch the whole direction to the opposite if you are so close to the this energy minima. So it's a
I agree with you that it's not too bad for the actual local structural description.
Yeah, it's but it could be improved if the larger model and training it more might also help, but mostly it's the how you align the environment.
Okay.
Like in the end, the problems were actually, for example, sulfur had the problems how the, if there comes another gold very close to the sulfur, it might get like a little bit freaked out, because there is now actually three golds very near, like which are the ones that are, if you don't make any kind of a very nice classification problem there or classification idea to see that which is the actual, the more important gold, is the one which is the nearest one or is the one that is a little bit further away, which are used for the alignment. That's the something mm-hmm. that might also improve it.
Yeah, the reason why I'm asking about improving systematically the force accuracy is because it's causing you problems during structural optimization, so convergence yes. problems and fluctuation problems, and that's difficult. I mean, you've demonstrated you can do structural optimization, which is a huge step forward. So already that is quite a good contribution. But I guess then the next step is how to make that more robust and stable, I guess. So related to structural optimization, I wanted to ask, you did a bit of tinkering around of how to conduct these structural optimization, how to initialize them, right? That's often the way that you initialize them has a big impact also on how they proceed later. And so the size of the step is something that you had tested. And I wondered if you had consider different ways of building the Hessian matrix to begin these structural optimizations. So there are some different strategies to do so, and it's often called preconditioning the Hessian. I don't know if you've looked into the literature for some of that. And I don't know if it would make any difference in your case, so just curious.
Yes, that actually plays a little bit role there, I have to admit, like especially when I'm resetting this Hessian matrix when I'm optimizing these whole clusters there, because how it's in a default setting, it's the Hessian matrix is just a unit matrix times some quite large constant number, like I think it's in ASE package it's around 70 or something like that, and what that causes is that the first initial step is quite large. So actually, I would say that in a resetting, if I would want to make it better, I would use a smaller value, like just maybe leaving that whole constant away, just making just a unit matrix. That would probably reduce the fluctuations. That is just I didn't do that here. I realized it more or less afterwards. I had already done many of these calculations. But in the end, I'm not totally sure how much this might, in the end, it reduces the fluctuation, but how much it helps the convergence, that's something that I'm not 100% sure, because I also tried to use ADAM optimizer. So I didn't just skipping the whole Hessian matrix, and that was actually converging slightly slower. Yes, slower than the BFGS, but in the end, it converged a little bit quite similarly in the end. And it has the same problems that at some point it might start to break. It just goes to the region where it's trying to extrapolate again, or the directions are not so well predicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a difficult problem. It's not clear if what is required is to occasionally incorporate more data into, compute more DFT points and then incorporate them into the model and then proceed a bit more and then do that. I mean, the neural network training potentials, they take that philosophy. It's very difficult and long to train, but because there's so much complexity in the system, it's not clear how to systematically improve it otherwise. Yeah, okay. So perhaps some of the last questions I have on this topic is, you didn't get to study too much of the structural features, because you spent so much time developing the methods. Now that I hear that you have quite a big group and that people near you are doing similar projects, what if somebody was to continue based on the model you proposed and the training you had done? So, okay, let's say that there are ways to systematically improve a little bit the accuracy of predictions and everything. So what kind of studies could they do then, structural studies or functional studies in future years? How do you think other people might build on your work?
Yes, that is a very crucial question. I haven't thought that too much, but I think the most important thing is this, in general, this MLM or minimal learning machine framework, because it's actually a very nice here that it's just still the same idea that it has some input data and the input space references, measures this similarity matrix, make a regression to the output similarities, and then you make a search for the actual result. And this is actually something that, because it's, even though it is called a distance-based I'm using here a distance-based or the Euclidean distance in an input space, it does not require that it has to be a distance or Euclidean distance. Like in here, I had this angle between vectors that, or dot product between these unit vectors. So that is actually something that is very useful to also know, that you can actually use, like in, we are starting actually a new project also, like starting from here, that you could actually, I think, use many different methods, like graph kernels, maybe implement this. So you would use, because they have shown to be very good to present this kind of atomic environments. So that might also be a very good idea to implement this kind of a similarity measures there. But how to actually really continue from here? Yeah, one way would be just to, if we want to improve this force model, maybe, but I have a little bit doubts how far you can go with this method without doing quite a really complex way to how to align the environments. It's more like a very interesting idea, but that's what I think is more important to know, that it's, you can really play around with this method. And you can actually, because it's I have seen some very interesting classification and clustering approaches which play with the nearest neighbor distances. So it's a, this could actually, because this is actually predicting those neighbor distances as a default. So it's could be used to, for example, analyze how these clusters might interact, like some kind of what are the main sites which will play a role in the interactions or something like that. There are so many things that one could do. And because in this Monaleo project, that cluster research field, there are not so many people who are doing machine learning. Like, I think there is pretty much like three groups that I know. We, and then there's the one which a group who has made this kind of a deep learning approach, and one group which is more or less trying to use this kind of classification methods to analyze the experimental data. So it's in our research field, it's we are trying to like bring these machine learning methods here. So we don't, it's not so well established yet.
Okay, but I'm starting to understand that your feeling is that after this work has laid the foundation, perhaps more method development is needed and more things could be tested to see if overall the accuracy could be improved still before it's used in any meaningful way to learn about structure or function. Is yes. that what you're saying? Yeah, okay.
Yes, it still needs to work. Like in current accuracy, I think it's reasonable. I can do some interesting things like the structure optimization, but to, for example, run some realistic MD simulation with a very high efficiency, it still needs lots of work.
Okay, good. I have one last question for you, and this is something I ask to all of the people that whose thesis I examine. If you could do it all over again, what is like the main thing that you would do differently?
Main thing to do differently? There would be actually quite a lot that I would probably just do very differently, especially because back 4 years, 2018, when I started this, there were not really any kind of good resources or material how to start using machine learning in any kind of a nano application. Like last 1 or 2 years, there have been so many different good review articles and instructions and many good packages that you can just start programming. Like it doesn't matter if it's Gaussian approximation potential kernels or deep learning. There are just so many resources currently. Like when I started, it feels like everything, there is those main articles and that's it. And then you just have to figure it out somehow. There were not so this kind of instructions that do this and this and this and you will get something. So that I would have more systematic approach that would be most like, for example, this image analysis. There is some parameters also that I didn't really even think about might play a role, but afterwards I thought that yeah, they actually have some important role there.
After the hyperparameter optimization of the descriptors.
Yes. And in general, it might be like trying to implement, for example, forces, this kind of potential energy prediction, like have those derivatives for the training or something like this. Kind of, these would be like a significant improvements, of course. But still, I'm looking back that our group didn't really have that much of a background on machine learning in nanoscience. So I'm actually quite satisfied that we came this far with this in the general, and we will have another dissertation hopefully in the end of the year, like coming from our same collaboration that we are doing here. So it's a really, like I would say that taking into account that from where we started, we get I'm quite pleased with the results that we have reached now.
Okay. Antti, thank you very much for all of your opinions and discussion. It's been a nice conversation, and let's now close this part of the examination. Perhaps I have only some last remarks to say. I wish to congratulate you on the work that you have done. It was quite an ambitious undertaking. And I think you have, as you said, considering the starting place, you have gone quite far and you have tested out a lot of things. You've worked very hard, it's clear. But I also wish to congratulate your supervisor and your whole group. They used to say that it takes a village to raise a child, but it really takes a village to do science. And I think it's very nice the way that in your group, this is kind of a group effort and that you have worked together. Your work is leaning on previous studies of other students and others will continue after you. And I think your group leader here, it deserves a lot of praise for his guidance and vision in this project. And I also wish to congratulate your computer science partners because these are very valuable collaborations to have. And through these collaborations, they're really the best way to advance science. But we all know that this is not easy because there are lots of difficulties collaborating across different research fields and communication issues as well. So I think it's very nice that your project was supported by computer science. And it clearly shows in the innovation aspect of your thesis. And the last thing I wanted to mention is that something that I mentioned at the very start in my opening remarks about the exploration mindset. That is, I think, very nice to see in this thesis. As you just pointed out, there's very little machine learning in this field of model layer protected clusters. And there are not many groups in the world that have this knowledge or are developing this knowledge. So I like the way that you have presented the thesis in a very didactic way, showing what worked and what didn't. I liked that the sentence that you closed your thesis on, which is, it is crucial to experiment with novel methods and via trial and error with the field will mature. So I very much agree with this sentiment. So thank you for bringing your own contribution to this field. And on this note, I think we can end the examination and I do recommend that the thesis be accepted.
So thank you for your insightful comments and a very nice discussion on dissertation. Tämän jälkeen kehotan niitä arvoisia läsnäolijoita, joilla on jotakin huomautettavaa väitöskirjan johdosta pyytämään puheenvuoroa Kustokselta.
I don't see any hands raising up. I also want to thank Dr. Todorovic remotely for very, very nice discussion and excellent set of questions. More of the interesting side also to sit in this chair of the chair and see what you are discussing. So thank you very much. And now the final thing to say is that the public examination is now concluded.
And afterwards, there is a coffee served in the restaurant Ylistö and also some cake. So everybody's welcome to attend.